This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
From the Blue Cliff Record, Case 3. Master Ma is unwell, part two. The pointer. One device, one object, one word, one phrase. The intent is that you'll have a place to enter. Still, this is gouging a wound in healthy flesh. It can become a nest or a den. The great function appears without abiding by fixed principles. The intent is that you'll realize there's something transcendental. It covers the sky and covers the earth, yet you cannot grasp it. This way will do, not this way will do too. This is too diffuse. This way won't do, not this way won't do either. This is too cut off. Without treading these two paths, what would be right? Please test. I cite this old case for you to see. The main case. The great master Matsu was unwell. The temple superintendent asked after him, "Teacher, how has your venerable health been in recent days?" Master Ma said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." The verse. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, what kind of people were the ancient emperors? For 20 years I've suffered bitterly. How many times I've gone down into the Blue Dragon's cave for you. This distress is worth recounting. Clear-eyed students shouldn't take it lightly. So last Sunday, I began this koan and really just focused on the pointer and a little bit of the main case, but coming out of a sickness, I wasn't in shape actually to do anything more than that. And so, but it worked out well to bring it into another talk. So today I want to talk about really the case itself. In the commentary, Yan Wu, who wrote the commentary for the Blue Cliff Record koans, said that this sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha is extremely difficult to see. Even Swedo, the compiler of the Blue Cliff Record, finds it difficult to versify this. And I would, for my own diminished place, agree with Yuan Wu that this is a difficult koan. I remember when I was working on it and seeing that and thinking, uh-oh. If he says it's really difficult. And there are koans like this that, I mean, in a sense, every koan, every teaching ripens, continues to ripen as the student ripens and develops him or herself. But there's some koans that are particularly like this, and sometimes they're particular to the student, that they have a particular sort of resonance or affinity or need for the student to clarify. And this is a koan, a teaching, and so the student feels drawn to it in that way, and sometimes it happens more subtly over time. But this is why, you know, when we chant the Dharmas are boundless, I vow to master them, to really understand the limitlessness of these teachings, which really means our own limitlessness, and how they have the capacity, and we have the capacity to continually deepen our understanding in ways that we cannot imagine in advance. And that the only way that happens is by staying intimately immersed in our practice, open in our mind, engaging in our attention. And so as I mentioned last week, he opens by saying, one device, one object, one word, one phrase, all of upaya, all of the skillful means of Buddhism has one intention, and as that is that you will have a place to enter. Enter into a study of the self, enter into a more realized understanding of the self. In a sense, all of practice is just this, is how to enter and understanding how to utilize practice, how to in fact make all of the forms and practices that we have skillful. Because although they can be true and have skillfulness inherent within them, they're not skillful if we're not skillful in receiving them. And so each of us has this one life, this we know. We may have different ideas about what happens next. Some may believe this is it. Some may believe in rebirth. Some may believe in heaven. But having this life, this we know. We are alive today. And so as practitioners, how do we enter? How do we enter free and unhindered into this very life so that we're not just going through our lives, performing the tasks of our lives, but actually living alive? How do we, within the ordinariness of our lives, how do we be free and unhindered in each moment? And what is the transcendental? Which is a bit of a tricky word, because transcendental is based in the sense of transcending. Transcending suggests that we're going to move beyond or apart from or outside of something. And that's not the Buddhist teaching, and that's not realization. And yet we can speak of the transcendental in the sense that there is something beyond what we perceive with our ordinary way of understanding things. And where do these two meet? The ordinariness of our lives and the transcendental. We speak of this as the absolute and relative, as the real and the phenomenal. In a sense, every religious tradition has some sense, some recognition of what we see when we open our eyes, and that there is something more, something beyond. Maybe that's what makes us human. I don't know what whales and other highly intelligent creatures, how they perceive that, but we do. It's fundamental and it's ancient that we both see that there is a world around us, we're in the midst of it, that's what we wake up to. And in some sense, it seems to be what we leave when we die, and that there is something, something more. Master Mao was one of the most luminous of the Chan masters. He was 8th century. He was said to have had about 70 some odd successors, quite a few. And so one wonders, in fact, scholars sometimes have wondered what was happening at such a time. You know, what was happening at the time of the Buddha when there are so many disciples of the Buddha that he recognizes having realized himself? And was it just a particular time when there was a kind of propitiousness or an inclination towards realization? Was there such a time that for Master Ma that he was able to bring so many students to understanding? Once he was teaching and said, apart from mind, there is no other Buddha. Apart from Buddha, there is no other mind. Just don't grasp what is good and don't reject what is bad. Arrive at the empty nature of all your transgressions. See that nothing is attained through continuous thinking. And know that because there is no self-nature, the three worlds are only mind. The myriad forms of the entire universe are the seal of the one true Dharma. Whatever forms are seen are but the perceptions of mind. But this mind is not independently existent. It doesn't exist on its own. It is codependent with form. You should speak appropriately about the affairs of your own life, for each matter you encounter constitutes the meaning of your existence, and your actions are without hindrance. The fruit of the Bodhisattva way is just thus, born of mind, taking names to be forms. Because of the knowledge of the emptiness of forms, birth is realized as no birth. Comprehending this, one acts in the fashion of one's time, wearing clothes, eating food, upholding the practices of a bodhisattva, and passing time in harmony with your circumstances. If one practices in this manner, is there anything more to be done? So he has said quite a bit here. In this tesho, in this koan, a few days before, Master Mao was walking in the woods, climbing the mountain upon which his monastery was based. And he was walking with another monk, and he saw a flat rock next to a cave, and he said, in a few days, this ruined old body will return to the ground. And indeed, only a few days afterwards, he took to his bed and died shortly thereafter. And so this dialogue is happening from his deathbed. Great Master Ma was unwell. He was dying. The temple superintendent asked him, "Teacher, how has your venerable health been in recent days?" And Master Ma said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." So sun-faced Buddha is the Buddha that lives for 1,800 years, an eternity, an eon, an infinity of time. Moon-faced Buddha lasts only a day and night, an instant, passing as it arises. And so what is Master Ma saying here? How are you feeling, old teacher, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha? Within one moment, there's an endless, boundless realm. How is that? Even a great being like Matsu lives within a fragile human form, subject to illness, aging, and death. When we ourselves find ourselves in such a form as we are currently, and our mind becomes crowded with our likes and our dislikes, what we want and what we don't want, then moments of discomfort become very large, very powerful, excessively important, larger than they are in reality. That's the power of our mind, is to take a seed, to take a speck of dust and create a mountain, or to take a mountain and turn it into a speck of dust. And so what is it to see things as they are in reality? When dying, when sick, when healthy, we project and imagine future, right? The way we want things to be, the way things should be, how things are going to turn out, how we want them to turn out. And the Buddha said, it's this realm that we live in so much of the time, which leads to endless conflict between what we want and what we have. And in that state, it's hard to be patient. It's hard to be patient with the way things are because they're not the way they should be. They're not the way we want them to be. And it's particularly hard when we are uncomfortable, when we're facing adversity, whether it's internal or external, when we're in pain, when we're struggling, and our body is giving us all kinds of signals, right? That we are in discomfort, that we are not in good health. Health being a state of wholeness, a state of being sound, a state of well-being, and an absence of illness. And this is very important, that we experience health as an absence of something. Which is why when we're in good health, we tend not to notice. But we could say that state of health is an absence of illness. But we don't experience it that way, although we experience illness as an absence of health. And so how do we face a very real reality, a moment in which our experience, our senses are telling us something is out of balance. Something needs to be restored. And there's a truth to that. And whether that's we're talking about illness, whether we're talking about dying, whether we're talking about a social order, the way things have been constructed that benefit others and some and oppress others. How do we meet our likes and dislikes and see the ones that are purely constructed and subjective and really have no essential truth to them, and others that are connected to something that are important? And so Master Ma says, don't grasp at what is good and reject what is bad. Very simple words. Very profound words. I mean, this is the fundamental teaching of Buddhism, that we grasp after pleasure and reject what is painful. When Master Ma was laying in his bed, being ill, what is it to just be ill? How do we train ourselves to experience things this way? When you're sitting on your cushion and something arises, what is it to just experience that as it is? Not as your, as what you want, as how it's more than you want or less than you want, how it fulfills something or doesn't, how it comforts or threatens, but how to just experience it as it is, and how to go further and experience it not without all of those descriptions and characteristics, but also as not belonging to you. To experience it not as your thought, your emotion, your discomfort, your pleasure, to trace it back to its root. Where then is the sickness and health? Where then is the right and wrong? The body and mind have no fixed form. The moment has no fixed form. And so as Master Mao was lying in his bed with his aches and pains, I suspect that he was sufficient in his illness, that he knew that this alone is sufficient. What does that mean? That this is a place to enter, that this is a place he has entered into this selflessness, into this great emptiness, into this great compassion. To not grasp at what is good and reject what is bad. The faith mind says, if you wish to move in harmony with the way, don't dislike even the worlds of senses and ideas. Indeed, to accept these fully is a manifestation of the enlightened mind. And so in the very moment when our senses are communicating, comfort or discomfort, likes or dislikes, to not grasp at those, which is, of course, what comes so easily, but not to see as the antidote to that, to dislike those either. And that's why in the pointer he says, this way will do, not this way will do. This is too diffuse. It's all okay. Right? Which is an idea. What he's saying in the faith mind is to accept them fully. What does it mean to accept fully? This kind of acceptance is unhindered. It's not conditional. It's not provisional on something. It's not provisional on if I accept this fully, then I will get what I want. You know, what is it when the condition that we're needing to accept is not going to change? I remember in Zazen, we were talking about in our talk yesterday, as we said, Sensei, about, you know, the experience that so many practitioners have had where you're sitting, you're uncomfortable, you're bored, you're tired, you know, you'd like this to change. And you, you're pretty confident that the timekeeper has like lost track of the time, right? That's the root of the problem here. And the monitor's not paying attention, and so you build up this whole thing where everybody's gone to sleep. You know, what's going on here anyway? And meanwhile, all that's happening is you're uncomfortable. Right? But it's hard to hold that. It's hard to actually just enter there. It's much easier to find somebody else to blame. And there's always somebody else to blame, even if you live on a desert island. You can still find somebody to blame in your mind. And I remember being in, of course, many such moments, but in one particular moment where it was at the very beginning of the period, or it was somewhere in the period, I don't know what, you know, where we were in the period, and I was in pain, and my mind started to go towards, you know, counting the moments, trying to calculate how much longer do we have, how much longer do I have to suffer this, blah, blah, blah. And then I realized this is the wrong way. This is not practicing. And so I shifted in my mind and I said, this period has no end. It has no end. And that was exactly, in a sense, the right view. Right? To accept it without provision, without condition. I accept this because I know it's going to end within a few minutes. I accept this because it's not going to end. So if something is going to shift, I have to shift. I need to stop relying on others. I need to stop waiting to be saved, waiting for the right conditions. Because in that, nothing changes. Or rather, what changes is just I continue to entrench myself in that sense of powerlessness, in that sense of turning my mind away. And so poised in the sitting on the seat here in this Zendo, we can be emboldened to do that, encouraged to do that, because you're in the Zendo. It's all about practice. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen here. But then what happens when you're at home in bed, sick, or you're facing the circumstances, which is stinking in its ordinariness, right? Reeking of ordinariness. Nothing special about it, right? It hasn't been set up for you, right? It's not part of Zen training. It's not the 10,000 dharmas. It's just like, you know, an ordinary mess, an ordinary difficulty. How then do you enter? What did Matsu say? We should see into the empty nature of our transgressions, which means the empty nature of every single thought, self-created. We should see that nothing is attained through continuous thoughts. We will not find what we're seeking, but just creating a more powerful fantasy. And that because there is no self-nature, the three worlds are mind. This world, this circumstance, this illness. And that doesn't mean that I am making myself sick. It doesn't mean that I shouldn't go to the doctor. It doesn't mean that I shouldn't attend to it in every way that I can to ameliorate the internal or external condition. It means be smart, take care of things, do what you can, but also to recognize that the suffering is mind. And so this acceptance, to accept fully, is a manifestation of the enlightened mind, has to be done completely. And sometimes acceptance is not true acceptance, but a subtle form of passivity or indifference or defeat, of just giving up. This way will do, not this way will do. There's no clarity here, there's no strength. It's not acceptance. Faith Mind says, one dharma is not different from another. There is one dharma, not many. Distinctions arise from the clinging needs of the deluded mind. And so when we differentiate, this is a moment of practice, this is not. This is worthy of my attention, this is not. This person matters, this person does not. These are distinctions that arise from our clinging minds based on our desires, self-serving. All the while, all dharmas are forms of emptiness. So which ones would we choose to practice? Which ones would we reject? Once when Master Ma was asked a question by a student, what is the essential meaning of Buddhism? Matsu said, what is the meaning of this moment? Will you find your way to tranquility, to peace, to harmony, through meaning, through understanding, through knowing, through descriptions, through that ultimately correct stream of thought that puts it all together? To go beyond the meaning. We begin in the meaning of things. We have to understand the teachings. We have to understand the nature of our mind, the nature of karma, how to do zazen. And so we use the conceptual mind, but we're learning how to use it well, how to use it rightly, rather than to be used by it through obsessive thinking and investing in our fantasies. But ultimately, all of that, as it's taught in the Buddha Dharma, is so that we gain enough understanding so that we're practicing well and powerfully, and so that we're gaining trust in what we might call the transcendental. What else is there? So that we can ultimately leap free of what we know and enter into that moment, sun-faced Buddha, within this boundless, endless space, there is a single moment. What is the interfusion? What was Master Ma saying? How are you feeling, Master? Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. An eon without boundary or time. This moment. Only this. What was he speaking about? In the commentary, Yan Wu cites some of the ways people have understood this. He said, these days, many people say that Master Ma was teaching the superintendent, giving him a teaching. Fortunately, Yan Wu says, this has no connection. Right now, there are many in this assembly who misunderstand. They put a glare in their eyes and say, it's here, the left eye is sun face. And then they say, it's here, the right eye is moon face. And he says, what relevance does this have? Even in the non-existent year of the ass, you won't have seen it even in a dream, understanding it this way. Some say that he meant to say to the superintendent, fix me some stomach medicine and bring me a bowl of it. Yan Wu says, what grasp has this got on it? So he's basically helping us. He's throwing out in advance all of the conjectures that we might come up with, right? Seeing it as an allegory, as a metaphor, as a symbolic teaching. All the things that we do that ultimately don't actually serve us. They don't transform our lives. They don't provide a place to enter. The conditioned mind frames and contains and defines and essentially domesticates reality. And so in the moment of woe is me, the sense that why is this happening to me? You know, is essentially a self-centered way of seeing the universe. That the world and everything in it is happening to me. And that when things are going my way, the world nods in affirmation, right? Has a plan for me and it's working out very nicely. Thank you very much. And when things are not going well, what's up with that? Right? What have I done to deserve this? I pay my dues, I pay my taxes, I'm a good boy, I do my practice, I uphold my end of the bargain. And the Buddha said, this is the fundamental way we will perceive things. This is me. I am this. This is mine in terms of what is my identity, what belongs to me, how I see myself. Past mind, future mind, present mind, they're all ungraspable. With which mind are you sick? With which mind do you make yourself well? Another time, Master Mao was asked by his disciple Baizhang, the great Baizhang, who said, what is the essential import of this school? Matsu said, it's just the place where you let go of your body and your life. That's all. That's the essential significance. It is the whole teaching, the tradition, all of what we call Buddhism is just that moment when you let go of body and mind. Master Dogen said, quietly think over whether this birth and all the things that arise together with this life are separate or not. Quietly reflect on this. Do we actually live in a world where everything is separate and distinct and autonomous? Everything functioning under its own power? Everything driving towards its own self-established purpose? That it is just a survival of the fittest. Off you go. May the forces be with you. Is that the world? Is that the way it is? Dogen says, there is neither a moment nor a thing that is apart from your life. There is neither an object nor a mind that is apart from birth. Mind is Buddha. He said, birth for this life is just like riding in a boat. You raise the sails, you steer, and although you maneuver the sail and the pole, the boat gives you the ride. And without the boat, you couldn't ride. But you ride in the boat, and your riding makes the boat what it is. As you ride in the boat, it's your riding that makes the boat what it is. Investigate just such a moment. At just such a moment, there is nothing but the world of the boat, and investigate and see that this moment in which there is nothing but the world of the boat includes the sky and the water and the shore. These are all the boat's world, which is not the same as a world that is not the boat. And so you make birth what it is, and you make birth your birth. Matsu said, attend to the affairs of your life, for each matter constitutes the totality of what you call your life. And this does not mean that we don't live in a world in which things are happening, in which people and forces impact upon us. Dogen said, the sky, the water, and the shore are all the boat's world. All of this is the world of the boat. And that's where we live, and that's where we make birth what is birth, and life what is life, and death what is death. He said, when you ride in this boat, your body and mind and the world around you together are the undivided activity of the boat, are suchness, things as they are, reality, unadorned. The entire earth and the entire sky are both the undivided activity of the boat. Thus, birth is nothing but you, and you are nothing but birth. When we look for peace in meaning or accomplishments or relationships, all of the good things of life, we cannot find them there until we understand all of that as the world of the boat. That's the only place we can take responsibility. To let go of body and life. To let go of seeing things as separate and distinct. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Tenkei Denson said, commenting on this, "But is everyone's own sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha long or short?" To forget the self and embody sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha is to live within the world of the senses, in this boat, in which everything is included, and to be an intimate contact. And we practice within this sensory world, not to just continue our grasping at what we like and our avoidance of what we don't like, but actually to become free and unhindered within the world of the senses. Because only then can we go beyond. The intent is that you'll realize there is something transcendental, there is something more than pain and pleasure. And only in realizing that can we truly be at peace within pain and pleasure and understand them as they are. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, what kind of people were the ancient emperors? It's kind of interesting. Yan Wu makes a point of saying that at the time of this, when this koan collection was being put together, the emperor didn't like these lines and wouldn't allow them to be included in the Buddhist canon. And Yan Wu makes a point of saying, Suedo is not talking about the emperor, but I'm not so sure. He's drawing from a poem that says, clothes in brocades and fine embroidery with falcons on their wrists, they go about at leisure, their manner scornful. They know nothing of the difficulties of sowing and harvesting. What kind of people were the ancient emperors? So you can imagine why the emperor thought that this was a criticism, right? And I have to think that maybe it was. But even Yan Wu had to redirect. But he says it's really about Master Matsu, which makes it much more powerful. What kind of people were these ancient masters? Were they the same as you and me or different? For 20 years I've suffered bitterly going down. How many times have I gone down into the Blue Dragon's cave? This is the cave in which, you know, during Open Sozan this morning, when students are talking about the challenges of practice, the difficulties of practice, facing the mind, encountering our entanglements. This is the cave of the Blue Dragon. It's the place of our suffering. It's the place of our greed, anger, and delusion. It's where we struggle and wrestle. But it's the cave of the dragon, the enlightened being. And the dragon has the jewel. Check her out at the front door. Right? That's what you have to wrestle with. Right? See her teeth. They are sharp. Check out her fangs, her claws. They are sharp. She's not messing around. And so to go down into the cave of the Blue Dragon is not a casual thing. To sit down and turn the light around is not a casual thing. We shouldn't make more of it, woe is me, but we shouldn't make light of it either. If it were not such an impactful thing, why would so much of our creative and economic and every other kind of juice in our culture be going to distraction, to manufacturing our distraction, to keeping our attention at all costs away from what is important? And why do we so gleefully go along? And when will it stop? That is the life of a practitioner, taking back your natural mind, taking back your life from those who would manipulate it for other purposes, and ultimately and most importantly, we ourselves. For 20 years, I've suffered bitterly. How many times have I gone down into the Blue Dragon's cave for you? And that's the way training works. We all have to go in together, teacher and student. When the Buddha realized enlightenment, he could have just stayed in the woods and lived his enlightened life. He spent the rest of his life in the cave of the Blue Dragon, because that's the only place where practice can occur, where training can occur, where the teachings can be offered and received. This distress, he says, is worth recounting, not to wallow in self-pity, but to just acknowledge the purpose is to have a place to enter. To recognize there is something beyond the ideas and the descriptions of this life, so that we can know for ourselves. And this distress that he talks about is not the same as the distress of samsara. You know, it's like when you feel confused or lost or struggling, but you have a path. That's a very, very different place to be than when you are just lost and struggling and confused and have nothing to take refuge in, nowhere to turn except samsara itself. We know how that goes. And so it's a very, very different kind of distress that's hard to understand. You know, it can sound just like, I don't know, sort of like having drunk the Kool-Aid to somebody who's outside. You know, that somehow we're all convincing ourselves that what's not okay is okay. No, that's not what it's about. It's knowing. It's knowing the distress, and it's also knowing there's a way through. It's knowing the distress and knowing that you are workable. And that even when you don't know the way forward, you do, in fact. You do. So don't take refuge in the self-deceit that you don't know. Having been introduced to the Dharma, now you know. It doesn't always mean it's going to be easy, and sometimes you may think you don't, and that seems valid. But in the end, we really know what we need to do, don't we? Don't we really know, essentially, what we need to be doing? And so we just need to do it. And the just is that cave of the Blue Dragon. It's a big, fat just. The Buddha spoke of this whole thing in this way. In this way, the suchness of all of your affirmations and negations, of your contractions, your confinement, and your expansions, is the very same suchness as your skandhas, as the elements of your sense fields, and all conditioned coexistence. And this is the suchness of all the dharmas and of the six perfections and of the four noble truths. And that is the suchness of all your wholesome and unwholesome thoughts, words, and actions. And this is the suchness of all the dharmas which are worldly and which are supramundane, transcendental, defiled and purified, conditioned and unconditioned. And this suchness of the conditioned and unconditioned is the suchness of past, present, and future. And this again is the suchness of the Buddha, the enlightened mind, and the suchness of every being. And it is thus that the suchness of the Buddha and the suchness of all beings are just one single, undivided suchness, indistinct. As indistinct, the suchness is indistinguishable. It cannot be known. It cannot be separated from anything else. And because it is indistinguishable, it is not divided. This is the suchness of all dharmas, which thanks to the perfection of wisdom, the mother of all Buddhas, the Buddha has fully realized. And in this way, this suchness of the mother of all Buddhas is the genetrix, the source of the Buddhas. And it is in this way that the perfection of wisdom is the teacher in the world. It is thus that the Buddha realizes the suchness of all dharmas, their truth, their unaltered suchness, and it is because of this that the Buddha is called Buddha. All things are originally perfect and complete. All things abide in their own dharma state. We see highs and lows, we see just and unjust, and we see that rightly. But what do we see? How do we see it? How do we understand this moment as containing the entirety, this moment of practice? If we don't understand in understanding moon face Buddha, if we don't understand sun face Buddha, then we don't understand the path, right? And this moment can become myopic, narrow, confined. If we only understand sun face Buddha, the path, the expansiveness, then where are we in this very moment? Where's our ground? What are we practicing? How do we see the merging, the unity of what we are, of what all things are? So I'll end with a verse. Today, just hours after the summer solstice, already the days are growing shorter. This fleeting human life, not fleeting. There is time sufficient to fill the eons. Mind is boundless enough to reveal the subtleties. Still, doors open and shut all at once. And where will you find today? Having brought ourselves here, being here, whether it's your first venture or whether you're a committed practitioner, we are in the midst of something. This we know. We have great power more than we know. We need each other more than we know. Where will we find today?
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.